Picture this. You're just driving on a busy commuter highway,
That's
right?
right.
Let's say you are on I-684, just making your typical midday drive. And out of nowhere, you hear that dreaded rhythmic thump, thump, thump coming from the passenger side.
Oh, the worst
It
sound.
really is. You realize you've got a flat tire. So the steering wheel gets heavy, you're checking your mirrors, and you manage to wrestle your car over the solid white line onto the shoulder.
Which is stressful enough on its own.
Exactly. You throw the car in park, you grip the steering wheel, and you just breathe this massive sigh of relief. You think to yourself, okay, thank goodness I'm safe.
Yeah, that's the natural instinct.
But if we look at the crash data and the safety analysis we are diving into today, you might have just parked your car in literally one of the most dangerous, highly kinetic places in the entire state of New York. Welcome to our latest deep dive, where our mission is to uncover the hidden dangers of the daily commute.
It is it's a genuinely terrifying realization when you start unpacking the reality of what the shoulder of a highway actually is.
Right.
You're sitting there, your heart rate is slowly coming down, and you feel like you've successfully escaped the active lanes. But what you have actually done is place yourself right at this lethal intersection of three things:
Which are?
aging infrastructure, massive commercial logistics, and human psychology. These heavily traveled corridors, we are talking about the main arteries connecting New York City, the Hudson Valley, Connecticut, they are absolute powder kegs for secondary collisions.
Okay, let's unpack this right out of the gate. Because pulling over onto the shoulder of a highway like I-684 or like the Sawmill River Parkway or the Hutchinson.
Oh, the hutch is notoriously tight.
Right. Psychologically, it feels like stepping onto the sidewalk. You feel like you have officially left the roadway.
Right, you think you're out of bounds.
Exactly. But the reality is, it's more like stepping off the sidewalk and deciding to stand right in the middle of a designated bicycle lane during a high-speed race. You feel like you've removed yourself from the main action, but you are completely exposed to secondary impacts.
That is a brilliant analogy, actually, because a bicycle lane is still part of the racetrack, even if it has a different painted line.
Yeah.
And to understand the mechanics of why these roads are so dangerous, we have to look at the specific geography of Westchester and New York City routes. Like I said, many of these parkways and interstates were designed decades ago.
Right, they weren't built for today's traffic.
Not at all. The Hutchinson River Parkway, for example, was originally designed in the 1920s for leisurely weekend drives. We're talking cars that maxed out at maybe 40 miles per hour.
Wow, 1920s.
Yeah. They simply do not accommodate the sheer volume of modern traffic, the aggressive 65 mile per hour baseline speeds, or, the massive 80,000 pound commercial trucks utilizing them today.
And our source material today gives us a very specific, real-world example of how fast this geography turns deadly.
Yeah, the Bedford incident.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The data details a recent incident that happened during the midday commute on I-684 near Exit 5 up in Bedford. A northbound Isuzu commercial delivery truck, which is a massive heavy vehicle, plowed into two disabled vehicles that were parked right there on the shoulder.
Just sitting there.
Yeah, just parked.
Oh.
Now, the authorities indicated the injuries in this specific crash were thankfully non-life-threatening, but the resulting chaos, the massive traffic delays, and the sheer destruction of the vehicles proves how fast a routine flat tire turns into a multi-vehicle disaster.
It really does.
But here's my question: why does this happen? I mean, a parked car isn't jumping out into traffic. Why are commercial trucks hitting stationary targets on the shoulder in broad daylight?
It's a great question, and it actually comes down to a fascinating yet completely deadly psychological phenomenon called target fixation.
Target fixation.
Yeah, it is essentially the moth to a flame effect for drivers.
Oh, wow.
When humans are operating a vehicle at high speeds, our motor functions are deeply tied to our visual focus. Our hands naturally steer the vehicle toward whatever our eyes are locked onto.
Wait, really? So you steer where you look?
Exactly. So if a fatigued truck driver or a distracted commuter spots a hazard on the shoulder, like your parked car with its hazard lights flashing, their brain flags it as a threat.
Okay, that makes sense.
They stare at it to make sure they don't hit it. But by fixating on it, they subconsciously drift the steering wheel just a few degrees, and they steer their vehicle right into the very thing they were trying to avoid.
That is wild. So your brain is actively trying to avoid the threat, but your body mechanics actually guide the multi-ton vehicle straight into it.
It's terrifying, but yes. And when you combine target fixation with sudden aggressive lane changes from commuters who are, trying to shave 30 seconds off their
Oh,
drive.
we've all seen that guy in I-287.
Right. Plus the fact that the shoulder is often only a few feet wide, your margin for error effectively drops to zero. This is what safety experts call the safe shoulder illusion.
The safe shoulder illusion.
Yeah. You are technically out of the lane, but physically you are still in the kill zone.
So what is the protocol? Like, how do you survive this? Because the source material outlines some very specific, actionable safety takeaways for stranded motorists, right?
Yes, vital protocols. First, you have to move your vehicle as far away from the active traffic as humanly possible. Do not just edge over the white line. Get as deep into the shoulder, onto the grass, or completely off the road if the terrain allows.
Right. And second is about visibility.
Right.
Immediately activate your hazard lights to give approaching drivers maximum warning time.
Exactly. Third, if it is safe to do so, get out of the car on the passenger side, away from traffic, and remain behind a physical barrier like a guardrail.
That makes a lot of sense. You want steel between you and the highway.
Yes. Fourth, absolutely avoid standing near the traffic lanes. Do not hover around the flat tire on the driver's side trying to inspect the damage. Just don't do it.
And finally, immediately call for roadside assistance or even emergency services.
And we really need to emphasize the why behind those steps. You cannot rely on the assumption that the driver barreling toward you at 65 miles per hour has actually noticed your stopped vehicle.
Because they might be looking at their phone, checking a GPS, or dealing with that target fixation we just talked about.
Exactly. Your primary goal is to make yourself physically removed from the kinetic energy of that roadway. Getting behind a guardrail puts a structural barrier between your human body and a multi-ton piece of moving machinery.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, though. I want to push back on this a bit, or at least, you know, play devil's advocate.
Kids, go for it.
Because real-world physics and commuter reality often clash. Let's say I'm in a minor fender bender with a delivery truck on I-287. It's rush hour. Cars are flying by at 75 miles per hour. My car gets sideswiped. The mirror is torn off. The door is dented. But the engine runs and I feel completely fine.
Okay, I see where you're going.
The standard advice is to stay at the scene, wait for the police, and document everything. But practically speaking, standing on the shoulder of I-287 feels like standing in front of a firing squad.
It really does.
Isn't it profoundly safer to just wave the truck driver down, signal them to follow me to a parking lot at the next exit, swap insurance information, and just go home? Why make a huge deal out of it right there on the highway?
I completely understand that instinct. The shoulder feels terrifying, and your brain is screaming at you to get away from the danger of the highway. However, driving away and treating it as a minor inconvenience based purely on how you feel in that exact moment is one of the most dangerous mistakes you can make.
Really?
The reason lies in evolutionary biology. When you are involved in a collision, even a minor one, your body recognizes the trauma and instantly floods your nervous system with adrenaline and endorphins.
All right, the fight or flight response.
Exactly. It is our ancient survival mechanism. It is quite literally designed to mask severe pain so that you can escape a predator. You might feel totally fine. You might just feel annoyed about your car door. But that adrenaline is completely masking the brutal kinetic physics of what just happened to your internal organs and your spine.
Break down those physics for me. Because like you mentioned earlier, we aren't just talking about two Honda Civics bumpers at a red light.
Right.
We're talking about massive mass disparity when commercial trucks are involved.
Exactly. Let's look at the basic formula for kinetic energy.
Right.
1/2 mass times velocity squared. A commercial truck, a delivery box truck, or a fully loaded 18-wheeler. It can weigh 20 to 30 times more than a standard passenger vehicle.
That is a staggering difference.
In a collision, the heavier object has an overwhelming amount of forward momentum. When it strikes your parked or slow-moving car, it transfers a terrifying amount of that kinetic energy directly into your vehicle.
So the car takes the hit.
Your car's steel frame and crumple zones will absorb some of that impact, but the rest of that energy is transferred directly into the occupants.
Which means your car might lurch forward and stop, but your body is still experiencing the force of that impact.
Precisely. This creates immense shear forces on the human body. Your head acts like a heavy pendulum attached to your neck. In a split second, it snaps violently back and forth.
Ouch.
Yeah. Now, the research explicitly notes that symptoms for truly catastrophic injuries resulting from these forces do not manifest immediately. We are talking about traumatic brain injuries where the brain physically impacts the inside of the skull.
And you wouldn't feel that right away.
Not always, because of the adrenaline.
Yeah.
We're also talking about herniated discs, micro tears in spinal ligaments, and internal bleeding. Soft tissue damage does not show up right away. The swelling takes time.
So it sneaks up on you.
Exactly. A slow internal bleed or a micro tear in a spinal disc might not hurt at all while you are standing on the side of the highway high on adrenaline, trying to swap insurance cards with the truck driver.
Wow. So you could drive away from that fender bender on I-287 thinking you totally dodged a bullet. You go home, you go to sleep, and 3 days later, the swelling hits your spinal cord and you literally cannot get out of bed.
Exactly. This is the mechanism behind delayed onset injuries, and it is precisely why seeking immediate medical attention right after a crash is absolutely non-negotiable.
Because you need a doctor to catch it.
First and foremost, yes, it is critical for your physical survival to catch a slow epidural hematoma or internal bleed before it becomes fatal. But secondly, it is critical for establishing a documented medical baseline.
What do you mean by medical baseline?
If you wait a week to see a doctor because you thought the pain would go away, the insurance company will argue that your injuries didn't happen in the crash at all.
Oh, I see. They'll try to blame it on something else.
Yes. They will claim you probably hurt your back lifting a heavy box in your garage over the weekend. Immediate same-day medical documentation legally connects your physical injury directly to the kinetic impact of the crash.
Which transitions us perfectly into the aftermath. Because surviving the metal-on-metal collision is really only chapter one. How a driver handles those first few hours and days dictates not only their physical recovery, but their legal survival against the massive multi-billion dollar insurance apparatus.
It's a whole different kind of battlefield.
It really is. The source material we are analyzing actually provides a very clear 5-step blueprint for navigating this exact scenario in the New York metropolitan area.
And following these steps in the precise order is vital, because the system is inherently designed to work against you from the moment the crash happens.
Okay, let's walk through this blueprint. Step one, as we just established, seek medical attention. Your health comes first, and adrenaline is a liar that hides severe injuries.
Absolutely.
Step two, contact law enforcement. Having an officer arrive to secure the scene and draft an official police report provides foundational, unbiased evidence of what occurred.
You need that official record.
Right. Step three, document the scene. If and only if you can do so safely from behind a barrier, take photographs of the vehicle damage, skid marks, and get contact information from independent witnesses. This locks in the facts before vehicles are towed away.
A crucial step.
But step four is where things take a really dark, almost Machiavellian turn. Step four is avoid speaking with insurance adjusters alone.
Yes. This is arguably the most critical psychological trap that victims fall into. What's fascinating here, and frankly quite disturbing, is the game being played behind the scenes by the insurance industry.
The game.
Yeah. People naturally assume that when they are involved in an accident, their insurance company, or the at-fault commercial driver's insurance, is there to help them recover and make them whole. But insurance companies deploy adjusters almost immediately. They begin their investigations sometimes within hours of the crash occurring.
Wait. So while I'm literally still sitting in the emergency room in an uncomfortable gown, waiting for the results of a CT scan, an adjuster is already building a corporate case against me.
Yes, and they will call your cell phone. And when they do, they will sound incredibly friendly, professional, and empathetic. They will ask a seemingly harmless question like, "Hi there, I'm so sorry about the accident. How are you feeling today?"
Which sounds nice.
It does. But they are absolutely not asking out of human compassion. Their sole fiduciary duty is to minimize payouts and protect their company's bottom line. They use sophisticated algorithms and software programs that look for specific keywords to devalue your claim.
So if I naturally just resort to social politeness and say, "Oh, I'm feeling a little better today, just some stiffness in my neck," they weaponize that politeness against me.
They weaponize it completely. These calls are recorded. They will use that exact recorded statement months later to deny your claim for a costly spinal surgery, arguing that you explicitly admitted on day one that you were feeling fine and just had minor stiffness.
That is incredibly manipulative.
It is. They are highly trained to extract statements that shift liability or minimize the severity of your injuries. They know you are in shock. They know you are stressed about missing work, and they will use that vulnerability to offer a tiny, fast settlement.
Hoping you will just take the cash and sign away your right to future medical care.
Exactly.
That is deeply unsettling. It's like playing a high-stakes game of chess against a supercomputer when you don't even know how the pieces move.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Which explains exactly why step five is so heavily emphasized in the research speak, with an experienced car accident lawyer.
Yeah.
You need someone who actually knows how to neutralize these corporate tactics.
You absolutely do.
Now, to illustrate how this works in practice, the source material profiles a very specific legal strategy through the lens of a local firm, the law offices of Norman Gershon. And looking at this objectively, it serves as a fascinating case study in the dynamics of legal leverage.
It really is an excellent case study in leverage. The profile of Norman Gershon illustrates a specific type of legal firepower. We are looking at an attorney with over 35 years of trial experience.
35 years?
Yeah. And importantly, it is highly localized experience. The source highlights his work across White Plains, Yonkers, New Rochelle, Mount Vernon, the Bronx, Manhattan, Queens, Brooklyn.
All the heavy traffic zones.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you commute in the greater New York area, this is the complex legal landscape with its specific county judges and jury pools that he navigates every single day.
Right. And the text points out a really interesting dynamic within the legal community itself. It notes that Norman Gershon is known specifically as, quote, the attorney other lawyers call to try their toughest cases.
Yes.
I want to break down the mechanics of that. What does that specific reputation matter to a commuter who just got rear-ended by an Amazon truck on the Cross County Parkway?
It all comes down to game theory and corporate risk assessment. What many people don't realize is that a large percentage of personal injury attorneys rarely, if ever, see the inside of a courtroom.
Really? I thought that was the whole job.
Not always. They operate on a volume model. They take in a lot of cases and they settle them out of court as quickly as possible, often for less than maximum value, just to avoid the immense cost and time of a trial. Insurance companies have massive databases tracking all of this.
Oh, wow.
They know exactly which lawyers will cave and settle and which ones will actually take a case all the way to a jury.
So if the insurance company's algorithm knows your lawyer is afraid of a trial, they just offer you pennies on the dollar because they know your representation won't put up a fight.
Precisely. Taking a case through discovery, depositions, and all the way to a jury trial requires a massive amount of financial resources, aggressive preparation, and specialized courtroom skill.
Which is where someone like Norman Gershon comes in.
Exactly. If an attorney with his reputation steps into the picture, the insurance company's calculus changes instantly. They know this litigator is fully prepared and well-resourced to take the fight to trial. The threat of facing a highly skilled trial lawyer forces the insurance company to assess the risk of losing a massive jury verdict.
And that threat is the leverage.
Yes. That threat compels them to offer a settlement that reflects what the catastrophic injury is actually worth. And importantly for the victim, this operates on a contingency fee model, meaning clients only pay if they win.
That is huge. That completely levels the financial playing field, allowing an injured commuter to take on a multi-billion dollar corporation without paying any upfront hourly fees.
It completely flips the power dynamic.
And the analysis lists several multi-million dollar verdicts that validate this exact strategy. We are talking about staggering numbers here. Let me read a few off. A $16.5 million verdict against the NYCTA.
Huge.
A $14.5 million settlement involving the Metropolitan Transit Authority. Over $5.4 million against Traviseo.
Right, and over $5 million involving Nissan Lyft of New York.
There's more. $3.75 million against Egg Depot, Inc. $3 million for Carmona versus Esther Transportation. $2.5 million against Sapin.
It's an incredible track record.
But rather than just focusing on the huge dollar signs, what stands out to me is who these verdicts are against. We are talking about massive municipal transit authorities and corporate trucking fleets. These are entities with bottomless legal budgets and armies of defense attorneys.
Exactly. It proves that a meticulously prepared trial strategy can dismantle a corporate war chest. Those numbers represent real human lives that were profoundly altered by catastrophic injuries.
Where the victims were finally able to secure the massive resources they needed for lifelong medical care.
Yeah. And when you read the client testimonials included in the analysis, a very clear picture emerges of the duality required to do this job well. One former client described him as a compassionate communicator, but, quote, a brilliant attorney, a beast in the courtroom.
A beast in the courtroom is exactly the kind of energy you want when a commercial trucking company is trying to deny your spinal surgery.
It is essential. You need someone who understands the profound human toll of the physical trauma, someone who listens to you, but who is absolutely relentless when dealing with the adjusters, the defense attorneys, and the judge.
Right.
Another client noted, he got me a settlement I never thought possible. That is the direct result of combining meticulous, overwhelming preparation with relentless courtroom advocacy.
And before we wrap this section up, I want to make sure we give you all the specific resource highlighted in this deep dive. If you find yourself in this terrible situation dealing with a truck crash or a severe collision in the New York area, the number you need to call is 914-485-4444. Again, that is 914-485-4844 for the law offices of Norman Gershon.
It's just good to have that information before you need it.
Exactly. So what does this all mean for us? What is the big takeaway here? If we pull back and look at the whole picture from today's deep dive, the lesson is that the daily commute on routes like I-684, I-287, or the Hutchinson River Parkway requires a level of active vigilance that we usually reserve for extreme weather.
It really does.
It requires understanding the volatile physics at play. It requires knowing exactly how to navigate the immediate aftermath of an emergency to protect yourself from the psychological trap of the safe shoulder illusion. And it requires understanding the sheer necessity of having a heavyweight legal advocate if you find yourself injured by a massive commercial entity.
Because the system is not built to help you.
Right, because every single time you merge onto that highway, you are sharing the road with 80,000-pound commercial machines. Being well-informed, understanding the unseen mechanics of a crash, and knowing your rights is absolutely your best, and sometimes your only, defense.
I think that is the perfect summary. And to build on that, I want to leave everyone with a final thought to mull over the next time they get behind the wheel. I want you to think about the illusion of the white line.
The illusion of the white line.
Yes. We are psychologically conditioned from the moment we first get our learner's permits to view that painted white line, the one separating the active highway lanes from the shoulder, as a magical force field.
Right, like an out-of-bounds marker in sports.
Exactly. We believe that if we cross it, we are safe. We stop treating that area as part of the hostile road. But when you truly consider the physics of a multi-ton commercial truck traveling at 65 miles per hour, driven by a fatigued driver who might be experiencing target fixation.
It's terrifying.
That white line is just a tiny bit of paint on the asphalt. It has zero kinetic stopping power. It is merely a suggestion to the drivers around you. So the next time you hear the thump-thump of a flat tire and you are forced to pull over, I challenge you to look at that white line and completely rethink your definition of what it means to be safe.
That is a sobering thought to leave on, but incredibly necessary. Thank you all for joining us on this deep dive. Stay vigilant out there on the roads. Remember what to do if the unexpected happens, and we will catch you on the next one.